Chapter 154. Tempest, I now approach an event in my life, so indelible, so awful, so bound by an infinite variety of ties to all that has preceded it, in these pages, that, from the beginning of my narrative, I have seen it growing larger and larger as I advanced, like a great tower in a plain, and throwing its forecast shadow even on the incidents of my childish days. For years after it occurred, I dreamed of it often. I have started up so vividly impressed by it, that its fury has yet seemed raging in my quiet room, in the still night. I dream of it sometimes, though at lengthened and uncertain intervals, to this hour. I have an association between it, and a stormy wind, or the lightest mention of a seashore, as strong as any of which my mind is conscious. As plainly as I behold what happened, I will try to write it down. I do not recall it, but see it done, for it happens again before me. The time drawing on rapidly for the sailing of the emigrant ship, my good old nurse, almost broken-hearted for me, when we first met, came up to London. I was constantly with her, and her brother, and the Micawbers, they being very much together, but Emily I never saw. One evening when the time was close at hand, I was alone with Peggotty and her brother. Our conversation turned on Ham. She described to us how tenderly he had taken leave of her, and how manfully and quietly he had borne himself. Most of all, of late, when she believed he was most tried. It was a subject of which the affectionate creature never tired, and our interest in hearing the many examples which she, who was so much with him, had to relate, was equal to hers in relating them. My aunt and I were at that time vacating the two cottages at Highgate, I intending to go abroad, and she to return to her house at Dover. We had a temporary lodging in Covent Garden. As I walked home to it, after this evening's conversation, reflecting on what had passed between Ham and myself, when I was last at Yarmouth, I wavered in the original purpose I had formed, of leaving a letter for Emily, when I should take leave of her uncle on board the ship, and thought it would be better to write to her now. She might desire, I thought, after receiving my communication, to send some parting word by me to her unhappy lover. I ought to give her the opportunity. I therefore sat down in my room, before going to bed, and wrote to her. I told her that I had seen him, and that he had requested me to tell her what I have already written in its place in these sheets. I faithfully repeated it. I had no need to enlarge upon it, if I had had the right. Its deep fidelity and goodness were not to be adorned by me or any man. I left it out, to be sent round in the morning, with a line to Mr. Peggotty, requesting him to give it to her, and went to bed at daybreak. I was weaker than I knew then, and, not falling asleep until the sun was up, lay late, and unrefreshed, next day. I was roused by the silent presence of my aunt at my bedside. I felt it in my sleep, as I suppose we all do feel such things. "Trot, my dear," apostrophe she said, when I opened my eyes, "I couldn't make up my mind to disturb you. Mr. Peggotty is here. Shall he come up?" Apostrophe apostrophe, I replied yes, and he soon appeared. "Master Davy," apostrophe he said, when we had shaken hands, "I give Emily your letter, sir, and she writ this here, and begged of me fur to ask you to read it, and if you see no hurt in't, to be so kind as take charge on't. Apostrophe, have you read it?" Apostrophe apostrophe said one. He nodded sorrowfully. I opened it, and read as follows. "I have got your message. Oh, what can I write, to thank you for your good and blessed kindness to me? I have put the words close to my heart. I shall keep them till I die. They are sharp thorns, but they are such comfort. I have prayed over them, oh, I have prayed so much. When I find what you are, and what uncle is, I think what God must be, and can cry to him. Goodbye forever. Now, my dear, my friend, goodbye forever in this world. In another world, if I am forgiven, I may wake a child, and come to you. All thanks and blessings. Farewell, evermore." Apostrophe, this, blotted with tears, was the letter. May I tell her as you need see no hurting, and as you'll be so kind as take charge on, Master Davy? Said Mr. Peggotty, when I had read it. Unquestionably, said I, but I am thinking, yes, Master Davy? I am thinking, said I, that I'll go down again to Yarmouth. There's time, and to spare, for me to go and come back before the ship sails. My mind is constantly running on him, in his solitude. To put this letter of her writing in his hand at this time, and to enable you to tell her, in the moment of parting, that he has got it, will be a kindness to both of them. I solemnly accepted his commission, dear good fellow, and cannot discharge it too completely. The journey is nothing to me. I am restless, and shall be better in motion. I'll go down tonight. Though he anxiously endeavored to dissuade me, I saw that he was of my mind, and this, if I had required to be confirmed in my intention, would have had the effect. He went round to the coach office, at my request, and took the box seat for me on the mail. In the evening I started, by that conveyance, down the road I had traversed under so many vicissitudes. Don't you think that, I asked the coachman, in the first stage out of London, a very remarkable sky? I don't remember to have seen one like it. Nor I not equal to it, he replied. That's wind, sir. There'll be mischief done at sea, I expect, before long. It was a murky confusion here and there blotted with a color like the color of the smoke from damp fuel of flying clouds, tossed up in two most remarkable heaps, suggesting greater heights in the clouds than there were depths below them to the bottom of the deepest hollows in the earth, through which the wild moon seemed to plunge headlong, as if, in a dread disturbance of the laws of nature, she had lost her way and were frightened. There had been a wind all day, and it was rising then, with an extraordinary great sound. In another hour it had much increased, and the sky was more overcast, and blew hard. But, as the night advanced, the clouds closing in and densely overspreading the whole sky, then very dark, it came on to blow, harder and harder. It still increased, until our horses could scarcely face the wind. Many times, in the dark part of the night, it was then late in September, when the nights were not short, the leaders turned about, or came to a dead stop, and we were often in serious apprehension, that the coach would be blown over. Sweeping gusts of rain came up before this storm, like showers of steel, and, at those times, when there was any shelter of trees or lee walls to be got, we were fain to stop, in a sheer impossibility of continuing the struggle. When the day broke, it blew harder and harder. I had been in Yarmouth, when the seamen said it blew great guns, but I had never known the like of this, or anything approaching to it. We came to Ipswich very late, having had to fight every inch of ground, since we were 10 miles out of London, and found a cluster of people in the marketplace, who had risen from their beds in the night, fearful of falling chimneys. Some of these, congregating about the inn yard, while we changed horses, told us of great sheets of lead having been ripped off a high church tower, and flung into a by street, which they then blocked up. Others had to tell of country people, coming in from neighboring villages, who had seen great trees lying torn out of the earth, and whole ricks scattered about the roads and fields. Still, there was no abatement in the storm, but it blew harder. As we struggled on, nearer and nearer to the sea, from which this mighty wind was blowing dead on shore, its force became more and more terrific. Long before we saw the sea, its spray was on our lips, and showered salt rain upon us. The water was out, over miles and miles of the flat country adjacent to Yarmouth, and every sheet and puddle lashed its banks, and had its stress of little breakers setting heavily towards us. When we came within sight of the sea, the waves on the horizon, caught at intervals above the rolling abyss, were like glimpses of another shore with towers and buildings. When at last we got into the town, the people came out to their doors, all aslant, and with streaming hair, making a wonder of the mail that had come through such a night. I put up at the old inn, and went down to look at the sea, staggering along the street, which was strewn with sand and seaweed, and with flying blotches of sea foam, afraid of falling slates and tiles, and holding by people I met at angry corners. Coming near the beach, I saw, not only the boatmen, but half the people of the town, lurking behind buildings, some, now and then braving the fury of the storm, to look away to sea, and blown sheer out of their course in trying to get zigzag back. Joining these groups, I found bewailing women whose husbands were away in herring or oyster boats, which there was too much reason to think might have foundered, before they could run in anywhere for safety. Grizzled old sailors were among the people, shaking their heads, as they looked from water to sky, and muttering to one another, ship owners, excited and uneasy, children, huddling together, and peering into older faces, even stout mariners, disturbed and anxious, leveling their glasses at the sea from behind places of shelter, as if they were surveying an enemy. The tremendous sea itself, when I could find sufficient pause to look at it, in the agitation of the blinding wind, the flying stones and sand, and the awful noise, confounded me. As the high watery walls came rolling in, and, at their highest, tumbled into surf, they looked as if the least would engulf the town. As the receding wave swept back with a hoarse roar, it seemed to scoop out deep caves in the beach, as if its purpose were to undermine the earth. When some white-headed billows thundered on, and dashed themselves to pieces, before they reached the land, every fragment of the late hull seemed possessed by the full might of its wrath, rushing to be gathered to the composition of another monster. Undulating hills were changed to valleys, undulating valleys, with a solitary storm bird sometimes skimming through them, were lifted up to hills. Masses of water shivered, and shook the beach with a booming sound. Every shape tumultuously rolled on, as soon as made, to change its shape and place, and beat another shape and place away. The ideal shore on the horizon, with its towers and buildings, rose and fell. The clouds fell fast and thick. I seemed to see a rending and upheaving of all nature. Not finding Ham among the people whom this memorable wind for it is still remembered down there, as the greatest ever known to blow upon that coast had brought together, I made my way to his house. It was shut, and as no one answered to my knocking, I went, by back ways and by lanes, to the yard where he worked. I learned, there, that he had gone to Lowestoft, to meet some sudden exigency of ship repairing in which his skill was required, but that he would be back tomorrow morning, in good time. I went back to the inn, and when I had washed and dressed, and tried to sleep, but in vain, it was 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I had not sat 5 minutes by the coffee room fire, when the waiter, coming to stir it, as an excuse for talking, told me that 2 colliers had gone down, with all hands, a few miles away, and that some other ships had been seen laboring hard in the roads, and trying, in great distress, to keep offshore. Mercy on them, and on all poor sailors, said he, if we had another night like the last. I was very much depressed in spirits, very solitary, and felt an uneasiness in Ham's not being there, disproportionate to the occasion. I was seriously affected, without knowing how much, by late events, and my long exposure to the fierce wind had confused me. There was that jumble in my thoughts and recollections, that I had lost the clear arrangement of time and distance. Thus, if I had gone out into the town, I should not have been surprised, I think, to encounter someone who I knew must be then in London. So to speak, there was in these respects a curious inattention in my mind. Yet it was busy too, with all the remembrances the place naturally awakened, and they were particularly distinct and vivid. In this state, the waiter's dismal intelligence about the ships immediately connected itself, without any effort of my volition, with my uneasiness about Ham. I was persuaded that I had an apprehension of his returning from Lowestoft by sea, and being lost. This grew so strong with me, that I resolved to go back to the yard, before I took my dinner, and ask the boat builder if he thought his attempting to return by sea at all likely. If he gave me the least reason to think so, I would go over to Lowestoft, and prevent it by bringing him with me. I hastily ordered my dinner, and went back to the yard. I was none too soon, for the boat builder, with a lantern in his hand, was locking the yard gate. He quite laughed when I asked him the question, and said there was no fear, no man in his senses, or out of them, would put off in such a gale of wind, least of all Ham Peggotty, who had been born to seafaring. So sensible of this, beforehand, that I had really felt ashamed of doing what I was nevertheless impelled to do, I went back to the inn. If such a wind could rise, I think it was rising. The howl and roar, the rattling of the doors and windows, the rumbling in the chimneys, the apparent rocking of the very house that sheltered me, and the prodigious tumult of the sea, were more fearful than in the morning. But there was now a great darkness besides, and that invested the storm with new terrors, real and fanciful. I could not eat, I could not sit still, I could not continue steadfast to anything. Something within me, faintly answering to the storm without, tossed up the depths of my memory, and made a tumult in them. Yet, in all the hurry of my thoughts, wild running with the thundering sea, the storm, and my uneasiness regarding Ham were always in the foreground. My dinner went away almost untasted, and I tried to refresh myself with a glass or two of wine. In vain. I fell into a dull slumber before the fire, without losing my consciousness, either of the uproar out of doors, or of the place in which I was. Both became overshadowed by a new and indefinable horror, and when I awoke, or rather when I shook off the lethargy that bound me in my chair, my whole frame thrilled with objectless and unintelligible fear. I walked to and fro, tried to read an old gazetteer, listened to the awful noises, looked at faces, scenes, and figures in the fire. At length, the steady ticking of the undisturbed clock on the wall tormented me to that degree that I resolved to go to bed. It was reassuring, on such a night, to be told that some of the inn servants had agreed together to sit up until morning. I went to bed, exceedingly weary and heavy, but, on my lying down, all such sensations vanished, as if by magic, and I was broad awake, with every sense refined. For hours I lay there, listening to the wind and water, imagining, now, that I heard shrieks out at sea, now, that I distinctly heard the firing of signal guns, and now, the fall of houses in the town. I got up, several times, and looked out, but could see nothing. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.